Welcome back, nerds, to Underrated Podcast. I have a little bit of a different setup today, so I'm sorry if it sounds like I'm in a cave or something. I'm in the office at home right now, so that is what we are dealing with. I hope you are doing well, and you are healthy, and you are dealing with what's going on in the world the best way you can. I thank you for spending a little bit of that time with me here at Underrated Podcast. My name is Q, and I am your host through all of these underrated media things. I have been reviewing Warehouse 13. We're going to take a little bit of a break. I am sure some of you are feeling this as well. It's a little tough to get motivated here, so I figured putting out something would be better than nothing. Hopefully, the motivation will return, as will Warehouse 13. We are so close to the end of season 2. We will get there, I promise you. But today, what I want to talk to you about is a film that I recently discovered and I think deserves a little more attention, as is the theme of this whole podcast. So, what I want to talk to you today is Vita and Virginia. Now, this film is about the brief but intense love affair between Vita Sackville-West and Virginia Woolf. Yes, that Virginia Woolf. And I just want to go into a little bit of background on the real-life players before we get into the movie. Vita Sackville-West, henceforth shall be called Vita, was a writer, poet, and landscape designer. Yes, she designed landscapes and gardens and things. How very British. She married Harold Nicholson, who was a British diplomat. Theirs was an unconventional marriage for the time, as both had relationships outside the matrimonial bedchamber with same-sex partners. I think Vita was a little less discerning in her romantic life, but Nicholson seems to maybe fit our understanding of bisexual. They had two children, one of whom would go on to write about his parents' lives in the book Portrait of a Marriage. It sounds really interesting, think it would be a great resource, and I would like to read it sometime. Now, Virginia Woolf. Again, most famous for her novels and for dying by suicide. Also, Nikki Kidd portrayed her that one time with the nose. You remember. You know what I'm talking about. The Hours? Anybody? All right. But I discovered that Virginia and her husband, Leonard, actually owned a printing press called Hogarth Press. And I only found that out because of this movie. So I'm not saying other people don't know that already. It's just something that I learned. They published essays and novels and letters through their press. They published The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot, books by Virginia Woolf, obviously, and even a couple of Vita's works. Hogarth Press even got to turn down James Joyce's Ulysses because their press capabilities were not big enough for that tome. Virginia and Leonard belonged to a literary slash art circle called the Bloomsbury Group, which included John Maynard Keynes, The Economist, E.M. Forster, and Virginia's sister Vanessa Bell, Vanessa's husband Clive Bell, and Vanessa's lover Duncan Grant. Yes, everybody in this circle seemed to have an open marriage. I mean, you do you, and you do them, and they do them. Whatever floats your boat, no judgment. I think it's fascinating. I couldn't do it. But that's something you have to learn and discover for yourself. All right. Now that the players are somewhat set, let's raise the curtain on our main feature. Vita and Virginia came out in 2018, but had been in somewhat production limbo as early as 2015. It's based on a play written by Eileen Atkins, who helped the eventual director Chana Button write the screenplay. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that name right. I am entirely not British enough to pronounce these names. Later, Atkins wanted her name removed from the credits. I have no idea why. I'm not sure that that actually happened. You just know that there was a bit of a thing. Gemma Arterton became the second actor attached to the role of Vida and then would keep it and would eventually become a producer on the film, actually. So she's been tied to this film almost since the beginning. Virginia Woolf was going to be played by Eva Green. I guess they were really going to lean into the witchy parts of Virginia Woolf, but then had to drop out because of scheduling conflicts. Eventually, after another actor dropped out, Elizabeth Debicki got the role. And as much as I loves me some Eva Green, I'm sure I will cover her in some future episode, I have a hard time seeing her playing Virginia Woolf. I don't know if it's the stature. I don't know. But I think it actually worked out because Debicki so thoroughly encapsulates this role that I'm glad she got the chance. She was the best part of DiCaprio's Gatsby playing Jordan Baker, and she was scene-stealing here as well. And I hear you. Let's get to the movie already. I hear you. Sorry. You know I likes me some background info. So let's dig in. The film opens with a sequence that cuts between Virginia in her office at the press, writing something while listening to Vida and Harold giving a radio interview about modern marriage. It's a really smart way to juxtapose the women and their worlds, while Vida is in the public eye, talking about being a writer and her satisfaction therein. Virginia is actually holed up in her office doing the work of writing. And it just so very quickly gives you a sense of these two women's lives. Cut to Isabella Rossellini playing Vida's mother. Yeah, you heard me. Who is not a great fan of her daughter's wayward life. We learn that Vida has made a habit of running off with a female companion. And this is actually true. She had a decades-long affair with Violet Trefusis. Again, not British enough to say that name. And they would be brought back to England a few times by various family members after running off. Vida claims it was just copy for her book. I think that's just the way Vida rolls, actually. We see that perhaps the only person who can cause Vida to kowtow is her mother. And this comes up a couple times in the film. Vida is a force of nature until her dear mama enters the picture. You can see how Vida's life is about kind of railing against this uptight and ostentatious life of her mother, while also benefiting from the freedom that her position in society allows. And actually, the one sticking point for Vida will be that she cannot inherit her family's ancestral home of Knoll because of England's laws, basically, because she's a woman. And that really just sticks with her entire life. Cut to a Bloomsbury costume party hosted by Renly Baratheon. That's right. The actor who played Renly plays Clive Bell, Virginia's brother-in-law. I haven't watched Game of Thrones in a long time, so I didn't recognize him. I had to be told by IMDb that that's who that was. Maybe you're more familiar with him. He doesn't have a beard here, so, you know, that might be the reason I was thrown off. Or a crown, or a shadow monster. You know, it's fine. None of those here. I don't think. Vida first sees Virginia wearing a 16th or 17th century man's costume. Historical clothing, not quite my thing. I would have to consult one of my friends. But anyways, that's kind of what it looks like. And now that I'm thinking about it, I can't really tell if Vida is actually wearing a costume. She looks kind of like Reno? Is that her name? From Anything Goes? She's kind of in that kind of a sailor outfit, but that's what she's been wearing all day. So I think Vida missed the costume memo. Anyways, And then I assume there was a missing scene because we cut awkwardly to the two women finding themselves alone in a room to acknowledge that they know about each other. Vita constantly tells Virginia how brilliant she is, and Virginia constantly pushes back that Vita is more successful. Then it's the end of the night, with just the wolves, the Bells, Vita, and Duncan Grant left. Vanessa Bell and Duncan Grant are dancing while everyone watches, until Virginia cuts in to wax poetic about being conscious of and living in a moment instead of moving on to the next bodily sensation. And now, I know what you're thinking. I have described the first 13 minutes of this movie in too much detail, unless I was doing a 4-hour podcast to cover the rest of the movie. Just stay with me, because I'm not going to use that much detail for the rest of it. I just set the stage to tell you that up to this point, I did not like this movie. In these 13 minutes, it contained all the tropes of little, quiet, indie films that I do not like. The music is not time period. There are weird cuts between scenes. Characters just stare at each other, not saying anything, and yet they magically have formed a bond. Someone stares with glazed eyes and spouts off some speech that on the surface sounds deep, but is just weird nonsense. Bosoms heave in breathless adoration of said nonsense. Bingo! Check them all off. They're all here. But then, after these 13 minutes, they pretty much disappear for the rest of the film. The soundtrack doesn't change. Isabel Waller-Bridge, yes, related to Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who did the soundtrack for this, keeps the electronica kind of soundscapey soundtrack, but it's never as jarring as it is in these first few minutes. It's like the director Button said, right, got that out of the way, we can maintain our indie cred, now let's move on with the rest of the show, shall we? It almost makes me think there was something in the stage play that they tried and failed to translate to the film. That's what it feels like to me. But anyways, I'm just glad they got it out of their systems. So after the party, Vita's seduction of Virginia begins in earnest. And I don't mean that necessarily in a sexual way. I just mean she is so determined to get Virginia into her inner circle that she comes on hot and heavy. We see that Vita is unaccustomed to not getting her way as Virginia puts her off for a time. And then Vita actually agrees to write for Hogarth Press, and the women finally have a face-to-face exchange. When Vita leaves the press, we see the first instance of the film handling Virginia's mental state. Other characters have alluded to it. Even Leonard says something to his wife about her not upsetting herself. Virginia has a vision of leaves growing on a fence and Vita slowing down to a standstill. And this will come up, I think, twice more in the movie. And I will share my thoughts when we get there. So then we get a series of letter writing sequences. I thought I wouldn't like these either, but they actually ended up making a lot of sense to me. Vita and Virginia stare straight on into the camera and basically read the letters out loud. It makes sense to me because of the intimacy of the things written, and it works better than, say, a voiceover, because they're writing these things, these thoughts, directly to the other woman. Not while they're engaged in other activities, just purely and directly focused on conveying their thoughts to the other person. For Vita, she's trying to impress Virginia with her writing and her mind and to show Virginia that she's worthy of the attention. And I think Virginia, words are what she has. She is so much better written down than she is in any sort of social interaction, which is Vita's world, right? So for Virginia, this is her working out her feelings and reactions to what Vita is giving to her. Also, doylist reasons of budget constraints, but it works. It works. Then we have this greenhouse scene, and I think this is a pivotal moment for the movie and the characters. Vita has returned after writing Seducers in Ecuador, which is an actual thing that she wrote for Hogarth Press. And that would place this roughly in 1924-ish. In real life, that means she and Virginia have known each other for about 2 years. She and Virginia meet up. Virginia says some insightful things to Vita about herself and her work, which Vita returns with yet more adulation of Virginia's work. And then Virginia drops some authorial truth bombs on Vita and immediately cuts the moment by saying she must get back to Leonard. He's been reading Mrs. Dalloway. I adore this moment. Elizabeth Debicki does such a great job of showing Virginia's passion for writing and being an author and what that means, mixed with her vulnerability. She believes in her craft. She knows how to write. But at the same time, I think mixed with not being commercially successful and also just having created something and having somebody else look at it, you don't know how that's going to land. And so we see the vulnerability of Virginia come out. And then all of a sudden, she just snaps right back to, okay, I have to go. It just rang so true to me as someone getting swept up in their passion of nerding out, basically, and living in a world that they know so well, and then realizing that they've let someone else see that, and they snap back to reality where they're not really good anymore, right? You're not really good at navigating the real world anymore. And social cues be damned, I have to leave. I think it's such a great scene. I think it's also where Virginia takes over as the driving force in the movie. It's like once she allowed herself to explain writing to Vita, she comes out from behind the closed doors and the edges of the screen and starts to be more active, I think, in the narrative. And when she approaches Leonard, we see the leaves return as she goes to ask him what he thought of Mrs. Dalloway. Except the leaves don't just climb the doorframe. They keep going and lay out in front of her, breaking the floorboards as she enters the room. Now, I don't know what it's like to hallucinate, but I do know anxiety, and I know how it feels to have this kind of second narrative running through your head during the day and how exhausting that is. So I can only imagine how tired and exhausting somebody like Virginia Woolf, who already has characters and stories running around in her head, would be while having to deal with mental health issues as well. And I think the movie handles this well because it doesn't try to say that her creativity comes from her mental health issues. So it's not trying to make it precious or like a superpower or anything like that. It was something that she dealt with every day and was a part of daily life for her. It also doesn't stop her from having a life. Yes, does she handle things differently than other people? Of course. But she also sees the world differently, so it's not hard to imagine that she would react as such. Then we go back and forth with the two women becoming ever closer. Vita spends time with Virginia's family. Virginia's sister, played by the vibrant Emerald Fennell, who I know from Call the Midwife, reassures Virginia that there are many ways to love. Meanwhile, Virginia keeps producing successful novels. The movie obviously condenses all this down to where it seems like hardly any time passes at all. In reality, this affair between the two women began in 1922, like I said, and carried on for anywhere from 7 to 10 years. And obviously the movie has to, you know, make it seem like hardly any time has passed at all, but this in reality took years. After Vita has been away for some time, Virginia finally admits that she wants Vita. And some people out there might be wondering why it would take so long. But again, credit to DeBecky and her acting. You can see on her face what a surprise this is to her and how it almost breaks her. She's surprised that Vita would continue to believe in her and her work, surprised at Vita's obvious romantic intentions, and ultimately surprised at her own response. Again, if you're unaccustomed to believing in yourself, it's very difficult to think that somebody else could. She has Leonard, obviously. She has Vanessa. But that might make it all the harder for her to believe that someone outside of the Bloomsbury group would think her worthy. And I think DeBecky just does this so brilliantly while staring straight at the camera, which I have to imagine is a tough gig. The women, after consummating this new level to their relationship, enjoy some happy times, some inspired times, and then Vita, being who she is, reverts to her philandering ways, which almost breaks Virginia. But instead, she uses it as a wake-up call, and this inspires her to write Orlando. It's also true to real life. Wolf did base Orlando on Vita, and Vita knew it. This time spent together writing the novel brings a renewed start to Vita and Virginia's romantic relationship, which, once again, all comes crashing to a halt when Virginia finds the copy of Orlando that she gifted to Vita as part of a package that Vita is sending to another paramour. Again, ripped from real life, Vita did that. Not trying to judge, I'm just saying it's an interesting choice. This brings us to the last scene between Vita and Virginia, and it has the two women discussing death because it's something Virginia thinks about intensely. Virginia was goth after the gothics and before all of us in the 90s were goth. You can tell in this scene that an end is coming. As the two women continue their conversation, they both start to get teary-eyed. It just feels like a culmination of something. Virginia is finally able to let Vita go because she can see her plainly now. And Vita thinks as a cold person. And Virginia says, no, not a cold, unfeeling aristocrat who chews people up and spits them out, but as a person who loves too much to focus that love on any one person for far too long. It's actually an admirable response, and again speaks to the kind of non-judgmental world and circles that these two women were drawing around themselves. And in recognizing this trait of Vita's, Virginia frees herself from Vita before being ensnared again. But like the epilogue states, the two women would remain close confidants until Virginia's death in 1941. And this ending brings all the things I like about this movie together. Virginia dominates the story by not even raising her voice. She is confident in her analysis of the situation. She sees the world before her plainly, even as it breaks her heart. She is at peace with her choices, and she knows what must be next. Vita, having herself reflected so clearly in Virginia's words, which have been something that Vita has clung to, right? So many times she's talked about how much she admires Virginia's writing. And so to have that wordsmithing turned on her is something that both delights and unnerves her, and I think That is the essence of who Vita is. The music and the lighting here are lush and ethereal at the same time as we close in on our two leading ladies, because this is not reality, but simply a possibility of what might have been. And I think Button does a good job of showing that. All right. In summary, why do I like this movie? Number one, the acting is great. Particularly, I've said it many times already, Elizabeth Debicki as Wolf. Arterton does what she can with Vita, but the meat of the story belongs to Wolf. Even the supporting cast is good here, though. Leonard and Harold look on as their wives form this bond. And Emerald Fennell playing the confused but devoted sister, trying to help her somewhat aloof sister navigate new territory. Button said she wanted a story where nobody says no to their partner, and I think she achieved it. Is there jealousy? Absolutely. But beyond that, there is a genuine desire for people to explore as full a range of experiences as they want and as they can. There's Tess in the background. Number two, the handling of Virginia's possible bipolar or manic depressive state of mind. I already said it, but I think Button depicts what having an invisible disability might feel like for someone. Number three, these are fully actualized women with internal and external lives. I know I said Vita has less to work with, but you still see that she is a mother, wife, author, designer. She has obligations to her family and outside of it. She's a part of high society, but she longs to be taken seriously. Meanwhile, Virginia has a life and family all her own, a business and career that came before and continues after the screen fades to black. She's a keen observer of life and its conditions, but she must borrow some of Vita's bon vivant character to bolster herself. We can see that these two talented women come together to push and pull each other into not better versions, just different versions of themselves. Number four. I don't know that this really clocks for anyone else, but I just thought it was interesting that you could draw parallels between Virginia Woolf having maybe her most productive slash successful writing period while carrying on with Vita, and compare that to Oscar Wilde having his most productive time during his affair with Bosie. I'm not a real creative type, but there might be something to be said here for all those stories about muses and inspiration. Number five, it defies slice of life indie film expectations. I already ran down my list of tropes I don't like. I just want to follow up with a couple more. So often in these indie films, the point at the end is that life goes on. Someone learns a terrible secret. They have overly emotional conversations about it. And then the end of the movie is a slow pan up to show that the rest of the world goes on. Are there emotional conversations in this movie? Absolutely. But that's not the only thing that happens. People laugh and kiss and all that other life stuff. And people are different at the end. Life does not just go on as though this is just a blip on the radar. And ultimately, that's what makes a good story. Things have changed. They are not the same at the end as they are at the beginning. And I think that's probably one of my favorite parts of this movie, is that you can tell that at the end, everyone has moved to a different spot from where they were at the beginning. All right, that's all I have. Vita and Virginia is on Hulu. I recommend it. If you've seen it, come talk to me on Twitter, underrated_pod. Email me info.underrated@gmail.com. Instagram, underrated_pod. All that good stuff. Thanks for hanging out. Peace, nerds. Thank you.